Welcome to the Urbane Uncovered podcast show, where it is my job to interview pioneering scientists and authors to tease out some of their most fascinating work. We discuss neuroscience and psychology tools for everyday living. I'm Ayatollah Urbane, and I'm a translational neuroscience student and a researcher at University College London. Also want to emphasize that this podcast is my personal goal of bringing zero cost to consumer information to the public. It is separate from my other roles. Now, the reason I'm recording this episode with a wonderful doctor is because around 1 in 5 residents in the UK will eventually develop an alcohol use disorder. You ask the question, why? Well, we'll see. Now, dependence during the lifetime can be difficult to deal with. And while some people will seek treatment for their, drinking problem, more than half of patients will go through withdrawal treatment and will relapse within just 2 weeks of discharge. Now, luckily, today I'm joined by Dr. Kiriaki Nicolaou. She also goes by the nickname Dr. Kiki. Her and her team have found a new form of brain training that has provided really positive results for people going through detox. Now, cognitive behavioral training has been around for quite some time, but it was used in the context of smoking and, cannabis use. Dr. Kiki really highlighted its usage with alcohol abuse. Dr. Kiki, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Dr. Nicolaou, you're a psychology lecturer at the University of Sussex, and you happen to investigate the neurocognitive underpinnings of, cognitive biases to alcohol-related stimuli. Can you tell me more about your work, please?
Yes. So I obviously was not the first person that started all of this. So the work on cognitive biases started way before I finished my PhD by now Professor Matt Field and also Professor Reinhard Veers in Amsterdam, but also by individuals who look at cognitive biases in emotion as well. So Professor Colin McLeod in Australia as well. And they collectively thought about biases in attention and also biases in terms of approach tendencies for drug-related stimuli. It all started with smoking. It all started with cigarette smoking and the work that Matt Field did.
Okay.
And also in parallel, the work that Reinhard Veers did in Holland with alcohol disorder, individuals with alcohol use disorder. The general idea is, and the way that Reinhard most kind of easily was able to explain it, is that if we consider the brain as having two main mechanisms, one which is represented by the horse and one which is represented by the jockey that is on top of the horse trying to keep control of the horse.
Okay.
The horse might be the limbic system, for example, for those of you who are familiar with the brain. It's the part of the brain that will elicit strong desires for things, will motivate us to do things, will elicit our responses to emotions as well, or to emotional stimuli. And then this system interacts quite a lot with a part of the brain that processes reward as well, known as the dopamine system.
All right.
And these two, the limbic and the dopamine system, interact to produce the effect of the horse. The horse wanting to run towards the desires, towards the things that we want to get, which can happen both consciously and unconsciously. So sometimes our conscious desires kind of match our unconscious wants, and sometimes we may not be fully aware of emotional desires and arousing desires that we may have. And then you've got this jockey who is in control of the horse, if you like. And this can be better explained by parts within the prefrontal part of the brain.
Okay.
otherwise known as the executive network. It's a whole network of regions that incorporate parts in the front parts of the brain that tend to control our reactions to emotions, tend to control or allow us to control reactions to emotions, allow us to control reactions to things that we desire or stimuli that might tell us that something that we desire is close by.
Okay.
So the idea behind biases is that, which are actually normal, you know, normal things, biases in our attention and biases in our behavior are normal things that allow us to adapt how, you know, how we live.
So do you mean that cognitive biases can be advantages, but only to a certain extent?
Well, they are normal, normal responses. So for example, think about when you're driving on a street. If you notice something red,
yes,
your attention will automatically be directed to this red object to make sure that it's not a red light or to make sure that it's not a red, you know, stop sign, for example. So these biases exist because we've associated certain events with other events and certain stimuli in our environment with other stimuli in the environment, and therefore are good because we are able to, rather than spending too long processing stimuli in our environment, we can just quickly direct our attention to where we should be looking at and therefore adapt our behavior and react normally. In the case of addiction, or in the case of even behavioral addiction, not just addiction to drugs, but also even gambling, the association between the environmental stimuli and the drug just becomes incredibly strong.
Yeah.
So that then the mechanisms in the brain that are essentially mediated by the horse are not in our control. And therefore, that is why we see either approach responses, so, or attentional responses to stimuli that relate to the drug.
Okay, got it. And you said something about a mismatch between the conscious and subconscious. What happens when that's the case, when there's a mismatch between our desires and wants and what reality has to offer us?
So we're not entirely sure. It seems to be the case that So our more kind of conscious desires, again, tend to involve more frontal related parts of the brain, whereas the ones that are more unconscious, if you like, tend to include those that involve the limbic and dopamine system. However, that's not always the case, because let's say, for example, I am currently hungry, and therefore I want to eat, so I'm motivated to eat because currently I'm hungry and I'm conscious of the fact that I'm hungry.
Okay.
While that same desire, so craving for food, will involve limbic and dopamine systems, I'm also consciously aware of it, if you see what I mean. So sometimes the conscious aspects converge, and other times they may not. So I may, for example, want to, let's say, not eat ice cream today, but it might be a nice hot day outside and I might suddenly get the urge to have ice cream because of the environmental cues signaling that it's a hot day. It might be nice to have ice cream, let's say.
All right. So context plays a huge role, I guess.
It does, yes, absolutely.
Okay, got it. And I mean, you've touched a lot on brain areas. And since this episode's quite focused on, you know, dealing with alcohol abuse, what brain areas are associated with abstinence control in alcoholics? Are these known?
No. So there is some evidence to suggest that when, let's say, impulsivity and parts of the brain, again, we are talking again about parts of the brain that tend to control the more limbic structure. So the parts of the brain that the jockey would be controlling, if you like.
Okay.
And those parts of the brain have been shown, so parts of the inferior frontal gyrus, for example, have been shown that if an individual, for example, is not able to, let's say, inhibit a behavioral response, or they're not able to do it effectively. And then therefore this particular region might show increased responses in higher responses in a scanner, let's say, for example.
Yeah.
In order for that behavior to be executed, that in some cases has been shown to predict relapse. So it's more to do with regions that functioning that tends to predict relapse. And then you could kind of reverse that and say, well, if somebody is quite good at inhibiting a behavioral response, mm-hmm. and parts of the frontal cortex respond the way that they should do, then they would be better able to abstain from alcohol, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you, doctor. And speaking of these brain mechanisms, what available training is there at the moment for alcohol abuse that target these mechanisms?
Yes. So thank you for asking me. So this is a large kind of family of behavioral type of training.
Okay.
Treatments. Collectively, they're all known by the name of cognitive training.
Okay.
Or cognitive modification training, whereby the purpose of the training is to strengthen the jockey. That's the purpose of the training. So consistently, the individual is presented, let's say, with stimuli that relates to the drug. So in the case of alcohol, it might be bottles of, you know, wine or glasses of wine full of some liquid. They might be consistently presented with these types of stimuli and also with stimuli that do not relate to the drug. So it might be a soda bottle or a bottle of water or a glass of water or something. Mm. And they are consistently trained to, in the case of attentional modification training, they are consistently trained to look away from the alcohol-related stimuli.
Okay.
And focus their attention on the non-alcohol-related stimuli. And they might do this for a period of 6, 8, even 11 weeks.
Okay, so people are repeatedly told to practically avoid alcohol-related stimuli and target their attention towards a neutral or maybe positive one. Is that it?
Precisely, yes. Precisely, yes. Okay. That's exactly right.
What would be an example of a positive one?
An example of a positive?
Yeah. A positive stimuli to direct their attention to.
So it would be anything that is not related to alcohol. And typically, because we want to make sure that the stimuli are matched to an extent.
Okay.
In the case of if we're using alcohol-related stimuli, we will use bottles of soda or bottles of juice or milk or these types of images. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's quite interesting. So it's more about... So you're manipulating their attention and the cognitive biases in hand. Is that
exactly
it? Okay?
Exactly.
And I mean, building on that, what do you find to be the most prominent advantages of this type of training in compared to the other therapies available?
I think one of the good things about it is that it's non-invasive, it's cheap, and it was always meant to be an add-on to existing treatment. So this was never meant. CBM treatment was never meant to replace the treatments that are available right now, such as, for example, the 12-step program or programs that require administration of acamprosate, for example, so pharmacological interventions. It was never meant to be a replacement. It was always meant to be an add-on.
Okay.
So that the individual at home could continue training a part of the brain that will in fact help them in the process of remaining abstinent, of continuing to remain abstinent as they follow their normal treatment regimen.
Okay, it's not a standalone type of treatment. So it's an add-on.
No.
And I think that's what makes it, so unique, because it's complementary. And at the same time, I believe that most, if you look at the 12-step program, Alcohol Anonymous, it's more mostly targeted towards people with, moderate to severe alcohol use disorder that are suffering from that. And it doesn't you know, kind of address people that just want to maybe cut down a little on their alcohol consumption, which is the case for most of people in society nowadays.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And we are finding that when we, so one of the things that we've been looking at in recent years, as well as trying to make sure that methodologically these types of training are good, like trying to figure out how much of the training we should give, how often a person should train, because it also has to do with the internal motivation of the individual.
Yeah.
But what we've managed to show so far is that if an individual is indeed, does indeed want to cut down or quit, it does work quite well for those individuals.
I mean, we've been praising and practically kind of trying to understand what cognitive bias training is all throughout mm-hmm. the episode. May I kindly know if there are any limitations? There are always
some things. Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is I guess this is where we are focusing all of our work at the moment, and,
okay.
and where my colleagues also in Holland and at Bath with Matt Field, and also in Australia, what they're doing. We are trying, there are two things that I would say we are not entirely sure about at the moment.
Okay.
One, I also already alluded to. So how often should a person train? Should the training happen at specific number of times during the week, or could the person be allowed to decide on their own how often they might want to train? Does it work better with some individuals who may also be highly impulsive, but still would like to cut down on their drinking? We're not so sure about that, for example.
Okay.
And the other thing that we are not entirely sure about is whether indeed any effects on drinking or smoking, because these are the two main kind of categories of drugs that CBM has been used with.
Okay.
Whether reductions that we see at the end of the treatment continue past the point of training. Or would it be the case that maybe an individual,
which is?
So it's looking to see whether the effects of the training go beyond when the training, let's say, stops. So they might be training for 6 or 8 or 11 weeks, but then if we follow them up 3 months later, maybe the advantages that they had at the end of, let's say, week 11 will not be there after 3 months, if you like.
All right. And are there any constraints to outcome measurements? As in, like, if you were probably, do you resort to self-reports if they were the ones reporting how much alcohol use was in place? Wouldn't it be a little biased?
Yes, and you're right there. In the majority of the studies that we've done, so like the clinical studies, I'm not talking about the proof of concept studies.
Mm.
So we've run a lot of studies just in, you know, student populations, in binge drinkers, let's say, in students who would like to cut down on their drinking, just to see whether a particular method of training might work.
Mm.
But in the, so these we call proof of concept studies. But in the clinical trials where they are much better controlled, in the sense that there is the real training, but then there is also this kind of sham training where a person just does the task. So they inhibit their attention either to one stimulus or to the other, not necessarily one or the other, to both.
Okay, thank you.
So this is training attention more generally.
Yeah. I mean, there are not major drawbacks. I feel like this is just space for future researchers to work on.
yes, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of other researchers, your colleague, her name was...
Marilisa Boffo.
Exactly. I will be putting her academic profile to give her credits for this. She has been working on very interesting technology. So she developed a smartphone version of the cognitive bias modification program, and it's called Swipe, right? So it enables users to personalize their training by selecting the alcohol beverage or brand they wish to avoid, which is quite creative. What are your thoughts on this technology, Doctor?
I've seen some really nice results so far from it. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant step forward. And she concentrated on the things that we know so far. So it's a type of app that I think does not include any of the caveats that I mentioned before in terms of how long should a person train, when should they do it. It allows the individual to choose and to continue doing it. So I think that's why so far they've had some quite interesting results.
Oh wow! I loved their personal touch to the entire program. I mean, I noticed that you can select pictures of your family, friends, even pets. It makes the person more eager to invest time. And effort in. So yeah.
I would hope so. Yes, and I quite like the fact that it's personalized stimuli as well. That's also important, and that's what I meant before by. She's kind of looked at the studies that we've done and the results that we've gotten and kind of tried to keep bits that work and use those bits within the app.
So it's built upon your studies.
Yeah, it's built upon the research that we've done at the University of Amsterdam, as a collective, because it's not just me, I've done more like just a couple of studies, but we were an entire lab of individuals who did this work.
May we kindly know the name of the lab?
Yes, so the lab is called the ADAPT Lab.
The ADAPT Lab.
It's at the University of Amsterdam.
Okay.
It's led by Professor Reinoud Veers.
All right. I'll be checking it out.
Yeah, I think you should check it out. There are quite a lot of wonderful PhD students who have just recently finished and who will be continuing on this work. I can already say there is one PhD student that we had, C. Venn, who conducted a massive trial, we're talking 580 people with a smoking related bias modification training, and she used both attentional biases and also training people to not approach alcohol stimuli, so to move away from nicotine related stimuli. So I would look out for that as well.
That's quite exciting. Speaking of that, where do you see the future of cognitive behavioral training heading towards?
I think what we can do is continue the add-on as an add-on. I think we could continue it in clinics.
Okay.
But the main thing is to make sure that we understand under what conditions it's more effective, who it's more effective for. Because you might imagine that if we give this training to absolutely every single person in a clinic, someone that may not benefit from it, it's unlikely that it will cause any harm because it's completely, harmless. But it would be more beneficial for individuals that, targeting it to individuals that would benefit more from this type of training, I think would be important in the future.
All right. And is there maybe a criterion onto that makes it maybe easier for us to identify who is going to be benefiting from the training more than?
So far research is still ongoing. Okay. It seems to be that individuals who react more to drug-related stimuli, either in the scanner or even if their blood pressure kind of increases in the presence of these stimuli, they tend to benefit more from this type of cognitive training.
All right, so we can maybe resort to blood tests, MRI scans. What about breathalyzers? Would those help?
So with breathalyzers, no, because that would kind of involve how much alcohol is actually in the blood.
So it's quite at scale. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anytime, honestly. I think I'll be reaching out to some of the PhD students, especially the girl.
Steven.
Yes, that you've mentioned. Yeah. That sounds like a huge, quite well, you know, run study. So might as well do so.
Yes.
So yeah, thank you so much. Dr. Kiki, as you go by that nickname, what takeaway advice would you give my listeners if they were to, you know, want to avoid this to begin with, you know, alcohol abuse in general in today's society? What advice would you really give?
I think the main advice that I would give is, if you can, let's say, for example, you've gone out and drank, you know, with friends and enjoyed yourself for 2 days, 3 days straight.
Yeah.
If you can try as hard as you can for the next 3 days, not to have a single drop. That's the best thing that you can do, because the more that cycle happens, the more difficult it is. To control.
So is abstinence key here?
I would say abstinence is key here, yes.
Lovely.
Because even we've shown that even small doses of alcohol can, in some individuals, get to the point where it's uncontrolled drinking afterwards. But it's, you know, just a small dose might result in uncontrolled drinking.
Yeah.
So my advice would be just spend 3 days of the week not having any alcohol at all.
It's quite the struggle, but worth it, I guess, because obviously the cons outweigh the pros here. So yes, abstinence is key. That's your takeaway here, folks. For all you listeners out there, I've provided
a not abstinence completely, but in moderation, as long as you make sure that you have few days in the week where you're not drinking.
Maybe a little detox, as we'd like to call it.
Yes, maybe a little detox, yeah.
Yeah, I think that will do.
Good.
So yeah, I've provided a link in the show notes below to Dr. Kiki's publications. And if you want to support the podcast, please subscribe on Spotify. Leave us a comment if you have any feedback for us. And thank you so much for listening. More importantly, thank you so much for your interest in science. I'll be talking to you very soon. Bye.